Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show. We've done this for a while now, and most of you know the drill. But if you don't, we have this group of booksellers, book experts, who join us in studio this time of year to tell us the books they recommend for the gift-giving season. Among our experts is Betsy Burton. She's co-founder of the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City.
My favorite novel this year, by far, is Playground by Richard Powers. You fall blindly in love with the characters, of which really there are only three who are major. Two of them are boys who become fast friends. They're from very different backgrounds, but they bond over games. These two are wonderful, but my favorite character is Evie. She's from Montreal. Her dad teaches her to dive, and she becomes as obsessive about diving as Ahab. She just loves diving. She loves the ocean, and she becomes a world-famous diver. Later in her life, she wants to describe one of the most brilliant and exciting experiences she's ever had in the ocean.
It had happened years before, on her second research trip to the waters of the continental shelf off the east coast of Australia. She had dived every day for 3 weeks when one afternoon she stopped a short distance from her field site to watch an excited giant cuttlefish moving about near the entrance to its den. The creature was pulsing in the most extraordinary colors. Evie drew close by centimeters, trying not to startle the animal and cut short its crazed display.
The book itself reveals the ocean as I have never seen it. And he does the same to the internet, which is its own kind of ocean. It takes all of this and it sort of does this high arc of the world we live in now, from the ocean of the internet to the ocean itself, and to our future, our probable future. And there's hope in this book. There always is in Powers, but there is enormous hope in this book, stemming from both oceans.
His entire body blanched as white as Antarctica, and he knotted himself into a wild warrior pose. Spiky goosebumps erupted all over his skin, which then burst into flame. The arms turned into swords, a saber dance for no one. He thrust his blades out everywhere, the spitting image of Kali, the goddess of time, change, destruction, and creation. The cuttlefish was putting on a play.
That's Robin Siegerman reading from Playground by Richard Powers. Along with Betsy, we have with us for the hour Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books and Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. And I got the conversation going by asking what books they're recommending at this very weird moment in time, on the heels of a pretty tumultuous presidential campaign and what seems to be a shift in American culture. Catherine went first.
What we end up talking a lot about in the store and in our personal lives is hearing people. There's a great urge for connection. There is an itch that I hear on both sides to no longer talk across one another. And one of the interesting things I've seen in some of the books that I've read recently is this loss of empire sensibility. I've got a lot of books that deal with various aspects of the Soviet Union or different times in history. What I can say is we're in a loss of certainty right now, and people are exploring all kinds of different ideas. The beauty of being a bookseller is that we trade in ideas. These things contain ideas and dreams. I'm clutching a book to my chest right now. And what we can do in our world is do that exploration with people.
Yeah, I like that. Ken, what about you?
Comfort food, Doug.
Right.
Really going back to old classics of literature. mysteries, sci-fi, all the great books of the past, reexamining them, yet at the same time trying to look forward, trying to be aware of everything that's going on, and subtly trying to bring in books with radical ideas and radical themes and what people are doing to fight things like censorship and books and libraries has become a huge, huge issue. And how to, and as Kat suggested, you know, not beating them over the head with it, but trying to provide alternate paths, alternate ideas and ways of doing things.
For me, and I think this is reflected in the books I've chosen today, you know, the great philosophies of the right and the left just have left me completely cold, and I don't even want to think about them. And what I want to think about and what I've read about and what's moving me is deeply personal books about deeply personal things. The people that I talk about in the fiction and the nonfiction are trying to find out what the people that they love really are like and if their connections are valid or not, what the thing they've dedicated their life to, does it really count? It's people, one by one, getting down to whatever reality they're looking for. And I find these books more moving than any that are sort of globally philosophical. And I think they tell a deeper truth.
Well, let's jump in, because I want to hear these books that you're holding that make the case. Let's start with Betsy. Betsy, you begin.
Well, as you've heard, my favorite book of the year is Playground by Richard Powers, and it is just a magnificent book. But that isn't to say that there isn't a lot of other good fiction. And I'm going to talk about Gabriel's Moon for a minute by William Boyd. This is a mystery thriller set in the 60s when the landscape of the world was really the Cold War, that is just the most interesting study of character that I think I've ever read. There's something about William Boyd, you know, you open page one and you start to read, and there is that story that we all hunger for. He's so good at telling the story. And in this one, it opens with a little boy in bed, has a little nightlight like a moon. His mom tucks him in. He goes to sleep. He wakes up. He sees the moon, and he sees smoke. He realizes there's something wrong, runs downstairs. His mom is dead on the floor. There are flames all around. He figures out a way to get out, and then the next time you see him, he's 30 years old, and he's a travel writer. He doesn't sleep at night. He has terrible nightmares. He uses his travel writing to distance himself from everybody. Somebody gives him something to give to somebody else in that old thriller fashion, and you think, don't take that. And at the same time, he decides he needs to go into therapy, which was just becoming a really big thing in the 60s. So there are these twin narratives of a man trying to find himself. Who is he? What happened back then that made him this man? And other people trying to draw him in and reframe him. So it's just a fascinating novel of character, and like all good thrillers, you can't put it down. Gabriel's Moon by William Boyd. Then Lazarus Man, Richard Price, I like to call, reviewers like to call the poet, the urban poet, because he writes about down and out people who live in urban settings, but he has a wonderful sense of humor. This one, an apartment falls down, the Lazarus Man. Last, there's a detective who's looking for other survivors from this, named Mary, who has the strangest marriage you've ever seen. This is 2008 Harlem. And there is, in her life, the funniest sex scene I've ever read anywhere. And there's a family of morticians. They used to be a dynasty in Harlem, and the proprietor is trying to save them all. Just this wonderful cast of characters, entertaining, but with a lot of compassion, too. It's a great book. Then Our Evenings. Now, Alan Hollinghurst wrote The Swimming Pool Library, which was a brilliant book, but was so painful to read that I don't think I ever quite recovered. So I quickly read the beginning to see if I thought it was going to be this, and there were two old men very happy together, and I thought, okay, I can do this. Anybody who's read Dance to the Music of Time will love this book. This young guy, his father, he never met, but he was clearly black. His mother is very typically white English. He gets a scholarship to a public school, so this book takes him through a public school where he doesn't belong, into academia, and then promptly out of it and into the world of theater, gives us this wonderful look at culture and theater and politics from the 60s to the present. Beautifully, beautifully written, Our Evenings by Alan Hollinghurst. And do I have one last one just quickly? Elizabeth Strout, who writes very simple sentences and tells very deep truths. And the thing that we were just talking about, Tell Me Everything, Lucy Barton and Olive Kittredge are telling each other stories. There's a case involving a murder, more stories. And in all these stories, all the characters are trying to figure out who the people they love are and indeed who they are. This is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout.
Great. Okay, Catherine Weller, on to you.
All right. I met this author at a bookseller's conference, Michael Edov. He was born in Riga during Soviet occupation, worked for GQ Russia as a journalist. So he knows this landscape, this thriller landscape he writes about. And I read a first couple pages and I'm like, okay, I'm in. Because what happens is there's a group of people on an airplane flying over Belarusian territory, and they look out the window to the side and there's a MiG jet just tracking them. And everybody in the plane immediately tenses up because they know it's going to be bad. They're getting kind of panicky. There's a point at which the pilot tries to make a run for the border, because if he can get out of Belarusian airspace, he won't be forced to land. He doesn't make it. The MiG cuts him off, and they turn around. And then a man gets up, and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very sorry. This is happening because of me." And he explains who he is. He's a journalist whom the Russians hate, and he's trying to escape. And everybody on the plane knows his podcast, knows his stuff, and they think, yeah, they're after him. And
well, I'm in.
Yeah, yeah. So the plane lands. They're taken to different interrogation rooms. People are let go. Two people don't come out, but he does. He is not the one that was taken. And then it's like, okay, so who was taken? Why were they taken? Why wasn't he taken? But then he's dead, you know, days later, poisoning anyway, because that's how the Russians really do it.
Right.
So, Collaborators by Michael Edov.
The Collaborators. Okay.
The Collaborators. Yeah. Next is one of the most beautiful books. Betsy and I were talking about it, and I was like, God, oh, I hope I can do this justice. Elif Shafak's new book, There Are Rivers in the Sky, is one of those tapestries of a novel. It begins with a boy who is born to mudlarks on the Thames in the 1700s, and the snowflake comes out of the sky and lands on his tongue and melts. And that piece of water moves throughout the narrative of this novel. There are rivers in the sky for them. It links in with the epic of Gilgamesh, the seeking of antiquities, the fate of the Yazidis in modern Middle Eastern territories. And it is the most stunning weaving of these stories, these women who are seeking to find their identities, to get out. This autodidact who was the boy born on the Thames who becomes the translator of the Epic of Gilgamesh. There is so much. It is so rich. It is so lovely. And I am not doing it justice. I'm sorry. So you just need to read it. It's There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak.
And you did do it justice.
Oh, thank you. Olga Tokarczuk is a dark, dark woman, and she takes people dark, dark places. This book, The Impusium, is a health resort horror story, they call it. It is takes place at the beginning of World War I. Up on a mountain, it's a sanitarium. Does it sound like the Magic Mountain? It kind of is. Except this is the Magic Mountain with psychedelics that they take all night. The entire erasure of women in this reality where they are the support mechanism, but nobody ever sees them. They are insignificant, insubstantial people. And are they really? And is the extreme masculinity that is in that sanitarium, it's got some dark secrets of its own, including a little bit of sacrifice.
Wow.
Lastly, I'm going to make a quick shout out to Haruki Murakami's book, City and Its Uncertain Walls. He's back, baby. This book is so much better than his last several novels. So read that.
Okay, say the title of that one again.
City and Its Uncertain Walls by Haruki Murakami.
All right, Kat, thanks very much. All right, Ken Sanders, over to you.
I want to start with a love story, Doug. It's by an author that we all know and some of us even love, arguably one of the greatest authors of the 20th century. This is a graphic novel interpretation of Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
Wow.
And it is. This, more so than the novel itself, it's almost a wordless novel, which you know I truly love. The first three pages are completely wordless. It goes from harsh black and whites into subtle tonings of greens and grays and browns and reds and colors. And it just really brings the power of the story. When you have a wordless novel, or a graphic novel, as this is more properly, we already know the story. So what do you have to carry the book? Mm. It's the artwork. It's the illustration. And Manu Larcenet does a masterful job of interpreting one of Cormac McCarthy's greatest novels, in my opinion. And it really does show through the despair and the apocalypse and the unknown and what the man and his son are facing in this unknown future. Just absolutely brilliant. Can't recommend it enough. And along the same lines, a second graphic novel. This one is about the mysterious author B. Traven, or if you're German, B. Traven. We don't know what the B stands for. So PM Press, one of our best radical publishers of today, has done a really interesting job in a graphic format novel of explaining who he was, why he mattered, and some of the controversies of his life. Traven wanted nothing but to be anonymous and let his work speak for itself. But by his obsessions on doing that, everyone became obsessed with him and not the work. And the work, his first novel published before he was ever published in English, he had sold 26 million novels in 31 languages, none of which were English, from the 19-teens through the 20s and the 30s. The Death Ship was one of his greatest, his first novel. The way most people that don't know him are going to know him is through Treasure of the Sierra Madre, yeah. The brilliant John Huston film that starred Humphrey Bogart and Tim Holt, the singing cowboy. Masterful novel. Some would argue, the late Charles Bowden would have argued, that The Bridge in the Jungle was his greatest novel, or which is not a jungle novel. He wrote seven polemical novels about the plight of the indigenous people in Chiapas around the time of the Mexican Revolution. This is just a really fascinating, interesting way of telling about a strange anonymous author. And lastly, not really fiction, but that librarian, Amanda Jones, she is an educator and librarian at the very school that she attended when she was a kid. She has fought off censorship, death threats, lawsuits, you name it. But she perseveres and she goes on and she perseveres. And this, too, is a love story.
Mm-hmm. And there's a cause we can all get our minds and our hearts around.
For sure.
Absolutely.
It's Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. We also have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks and Betsy Burton. She's the co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. We have a list of all of these titles and the ones we won't get to. It's on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show, where we've gathered our group of book experts to offer ideas for the gift-giving time of year. We have with us Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop, Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, and Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. On Catherine's list this year is The Forbidden Garden by Simon Parkin. It plays out in Russia in the Second World War when the Axis powers had blockaded Leningrad and more than a million people died.
When the city went under siege, it also contained the world's largest seed collection in order to help prevent famines of the future. As word came down that the siege was happening, there were people who could get out. But the seed lab was leaderless, so they didn't quite know what to do or how to get things out. And most of the staff ended up staying in Leningrad as the siege began and through the siege. There's this moment where the ice over a lake is still frozen hard enough that they can load trucks with people and with seeds and evacuate people. So the people who leave strap seeds to their bodies that they have been protecting and not eating, though they could eat them unbeknownst to anybody. They took a vow to not eat those seeds, to protect them above all else. So they strap the seeds to their bodies and they get on the truck.
As the vehicle pulled up at the first of the huts near the hamlet of Kobona, nurses and orderlies ran across the snow to greet and tend to the frozen evacuees. Each passenger was helped off the vehicle in turn, at which point a nurse checked them over, rubbing snow into their faces and hands. Rubtsov was alive, but unable to stand. The orderlies lifted him from the rear of the truck and placed him on a stretcher. Then they carried him to a nearby field hospital. Within a few hours, Rubtsov was dead. As the nurse unbuttoned his shirt, she found the seed package tied to his chest. Inside, it contained 4 pounds of grain. "Why?" the young woman cried in disbelief. "He might have saved himself." Another of the seed bank staff raised himself onto one elbow. "For life. For the children you'll have after the war. He was carrying seeds. He was keeping them warm. Give them to one of our people. Whoever makes it out alive can hand them on."
This book contains one of the deepest ethical questions, and that is, do you save yourself? Do you save the people who are with you right now? Or do you sacrifice that for what you know will come next, to have the faith that there will be a future? And these people who knew famine, they knowingly and willingly, repeatedly sacrificed themselves for the future.
That's the book, The Forbidden Garden, by Simon Parkin. We heard the actor Elliot Fitzpatrick reading from it. So we're at round two. Back to Catherine.
My first nonfiction pick, as we've talked about, there's a lot of exploration going on. And one of the explorations I've been seeing in my bookstore, and I know Betsy and Ken have too, is other spiritualities. There's a great reawakening in what we call body, mind, spirit, metaphysics, whatever. The astrology, the tarot, the witchcraft, all of the all. It's people are coming in hard for it.
Young people?
And some people our age are coming back to it, I think, after having left it behind for science or money. I don't know. But this book, Witches Among Us by Thorne Mooney. Thorne is a witch. This book explains witchcraft. It's not for the practitioner. It's for the person who wants to understand what the person in their life who is a practitioner is doing. It is all inclusive. She's also an academic, so it can have kind of an academic tone. And it's very much, this is the world, and some witches do this and other people don't. And that's kind of how witchcraft is. It's very personal. But she does a very good job of describing those nuances and the personal nature of witchcraft. So, Thorne Mooney with Witches Among Us. Going back to the 70s in Los Angeles, this book, Didion and Babbitt by Lily Annalick, is, oh my, it is just off the hook.
What do you mean?
It is so big and so colorful. Huh. Eve Babbitt herself is an enormously colorful and off-the-chain character. A lot of people don't know about her. She did a lot of writing in the 70s. She designed album covers, Buffalo Springfield album covers, as a matter of fact. And her books are now being republished by the New York Review of Books Classics series. The kids in my store are coming in hard for Eve Babbitt because she was like this thoroughly embodied, unashamed agent of chaos, and at a time when there was a lot of chaos, right? And it pivots her with Joan Didion, the very controlled, disciplined, measured person of the time. They knew each other. They ran in the same circles. And this book starts with the author, Lily, going to Babbitt's archives and finding a letter that Babbitt wrote to Joan Didion, giving her hell for not liking Virginia Woolf. And it's a really good letter. So these two women, two different approaches to a different wild time. It's a study in contrast that really takes you deep in it. It's called Didion and Babbitt by Lily Annalick, and it is so dishy.
Even better. Yeah.
Yeah. Next book, Absinthe Forger by Evan Rail. People are still obsessed with what absinthe was. Did it make people go mad? Did they really hallucinate? There's still a huge thing about absinthe. This guy goes deep into the history of absinthe, but also why people collect it and spend thousands and thousands of dollars to get what is purportedly an old bottle of absinthe. And is it? Not so much. It's really a great true crime trip. Absinthe Forger by Evan Rail.
Great. Those are great. All right. Ken Sanders.
I stumbled into this new book by it's edited by Zan Merrill and Nikki Naser, too. Southwestern river women for many, many decades now. They were camping. There's about a dozen of them that have come and gone over the decades. They all still row their own boats down the Desolation Canyon, Cataract, the San Juan, and many, many others. And they were camped on a San Juan trip when a lone male in a boat came by, saw these women on the bank of the river and said, shouted out to them, "Where are your men?" So that gave them the idea of doing this book. So they've got contributions from 36 different female river runners.
Oh,
they acknowledge called Rafting Western Rivers with the Ladies. Where are your men? Just the title alone. And I can't tell you, Doug, what it's like to go down with an all-women river trip. I don't think I'm ever going to have that experience.
But
what I want to say, though, is these women and their stories are just outrageously funny. And they don't like to focus on their age. To them, as I said, it's about the doing of the thing, and they all still do it. I think that's pretty cool. And learning new things from women. We have The Explorers, A New History of America in 10 Expeditions by Amanda Bellows. The 10 she chooses are very interesting because some we've heard of starts out with Lewis and Clark, but her is based on Sacagawea, hardly covering new ground there. Then she goes to Mountain Men, James Beckwith. Here's one I wouldn't have thought to include in the anthology, Laura Ingalls Wilder, as in the category of the homesteader. Pretty interesting. And she's schooling me here. I think I know a lot about natural history and the environment. Florence Miriam Bailey, the conservationist. She was probably 19th century Rachel Carson when it comes to birds. I have to confess, I've never heard of this woman before, and it was fascinating reading in a time when Audubon and other greats, you know, mostly between sportsmen and great explorers like Audubon, we were extincting birds and animal species like there was no tomorrow. And it ends with Amelia Earhart, the aviator, and Sally Ride, the astronaut. Huh. So it's really expanding the boundaries of exploration. I want to turn quickly to an old book. It's been long out of print, but I have a giant stash of these things. Glen Canyon Before Lake Powell, The Colorado River Through by this book is by Eleanor Inskeep, an old naturalist park woman at Arches National Monument. It's a beautiful photo and text documentary of the place that used to be called the place no one knew, the place that's coming back, and people are really, really interested in it. And here's a book about it that you can buy that doesn't cost a fortune.
Mm, great Christmas present. I'm going to go
there
buy
you
one.
Go. All right, Betsy.
Okay. Well, the first one that I'm bringing is Thirst, Great Salt Lake. It's by Faisal. He's a photographer and a close friend of Terry Tempest Williams. And they have inside of it what they call an essay, but it's a pretty major essay. It's very small print and a very big essay about what the book is about, which is really the death of Great Salt Lake. Of course, it's about drought, and it's about the way we cut off water and the way we cut the lake off from itself, but it's about industrialization and what that's done. And it's the most magnificent book of modern art you've ever seen. It is about the death of Great Salt Lake, and I wish people would take it more seriously because it's going to have us all if we don't. So there's one local.
Say the name of it again.
Thirst. And then Great Salt Lake.
Yeah.
So this is a book by Georgia Perrin Ball called So Why Not? Very different. She's local, or was, and she was a realtor. So people who bought and sold houses will know her. She was with the Ramsey Group, and she was the broker. So, and she was head of the Realty Society, and she did all kinds of things before that. And then she learned to sail on the Great Salt Lake, and she took expeditions to Turkey and all over the place. And it's all about, so why not? So her next act after all that was she was visiting her daughter in Provence, and she thought, you know what, it'd be pretty cool to have a B&B here. So she bought this beautiful property for not very much money. This is the Maze. And she ran. She was 65 then. She came back, talked to her colleagues, and they said, are you kidding me? You're nuts. She did it for 20 years. I've been there four times. It was the best place I ever went. It's just a perfect book for young women. I mean, it's a perfect book for anybody who knows this territory. But for young women, you know, when they get done with whatever training they have and they walk into the world and they think, what am I going to do? You say, A, what are your dreams? And then whatever objections people give you, say, so why not? Follow George's advice. It's just a charming book. Great Christmas present. Then I won't say much about this because I'm running out of time, but also because this isn't new. Stephen Fry wrote Mythos many years ago, 2017, I think, retelling the Greek myths, and this is a new illustrated edition. The illustrations are just spectacular throughout.
Just to say, Stephen Fry, the actor, by the way, who a lot of people didn't realize
he had
this life as a writer. Yes, Blackadder,
and has a wonderful comic voice in these tales.
Yeah.
Many of which are very off-color, by the way. So it's a coffee table book, but it depends on who's at your coffee table.
Right.
Okay, so then, just quickly, Oliver Sacks' letters, 700 pages. I can't believe I read it, but I did. And, you know, he is both reviled and adored. Reviled because they thought he wasn't, quote, the doctor that he should have been. Mm-hmm. Adored by his patients and by people who believe that medicine is about more than chemistry. And these letters, I mean, there's love letters in here, so passionate that you takes your breath away. Letters to his family, letters to colleagues. He was a correspondent with William Auden. He was, you know, he knew every writer, he knew every famous scientist, his colleagues, his patients. And through it all, you really get a picture you really get a picture of medicine and that crack that I just talked about between is it chemistry, is it humanity, or what piece of which. It's just a fascinating book, and it is very long but goes very fast. Letters by Oliver Sacks.
It's Betsy Burton. She co-founded the King's English Bookshop at the 15th and 15th neighborhood of Salt Lake City. She's here with Catherine Weller of Weller Book Works in Trolley Square, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books in the Leonardo on Library Square in Salt Lake City. We have a list of all of the books, even the ones we didn't have time for, on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about books today with our usual group of experts. They've joined us to help you decide which books to give for the holiday. And Ken Sanders always has something unique on his list. And this year it was a book about bears. Two bears, actually.
My friends Lynn and Doug Seuss moved to the Heber Valley in early 1970s, and soon acquired a grizzly bear cub. And they raised this bear they named Bart from a cub up until his death. And Bart made his screen appearance as Bart the Bear as a mere cub in the old Grizzly Adams TV show that they filmed here in Utah, and went on to probably be one of the most famous animal actors of all time in the movies. Movies like Great Outdoors on Deadly Ground, The Edge, The Bear, Legends of the Fall. After Bart 1 passed, the Seusses raised not only Bart 2, but Honey Bump and every kind of animal that you can imagine. One really funny story about Bart 1 is they had him on a set somewhere camping and had never seen a prairie dog before. And all of a sudden, this field's full of hundreds of prairie dogs. Bart, like, oh my gosh, what are those? He was so scared, he ran behind his tiny human Doug and hid behind. Not that a 9.5 foot tall, over 1,000 pound bear can hide behind a tiny human, but he tried because Doug needed to save him or protect him from the prairie dogs. Lynn Seuss wrote the book, The Grizzlies and Us. It's a joyful book. The Seusses are truly remarkable, unique people, and this book gives us a taste of that. This is a story that no one else can tell. That is, unless one has over 50 years of singular memories with 5 grizzly bears, a black bear, wolf packs, cougars, coyotes, eagles, foxes, bobcats, owls, raccoons, deer, a badger named Billy, and a trio of human children. One would also need to turn back the clock many years to a time we will never see again, when grizzly bears in films were real. This is the story of Bart the Bear and Bart the Bear 2, considered by many to be the most extraordinary animal actors of all time. It is a love story. They're just beautiful stories that I think that this time of season, this time of year, this time in our own personal lives and that of our country, we need some feel-good stories. And this is a book of joy.
Okay, it's on to children's books now, and back to Ken.
Doug, we all started as children. Some of us grew up. Poet Laureate Ada Limón has a brand new children's book called In Praise of Mystery, illustrated by Peter Siss, the wonderful Peter Siss. And the best thing I like about this book, Doug, it's almost a wordless novel again. Oh, it's so much fun. The artwork is so beautiful. Very light text, but and there's all this subtle stuff going on about In Praise of Mystery, and it uses, you know, our skies and the universe as its backdrop. But it creates these little things like, it kind of looks like Vincent van Gogh there to me. I just truly love this little book. Peter Siss, Ada Limón, In Praise of Mystery. Mm. My first book of fancy letters by Jessica Hish. It's just, again, very, very simple, wonderful for young children, beautifully calligraphed with artwork letters. And did you know letters come in all shapes and sizes? Athletic, bubbly, creepy? And it just goes on and shows you through an alphabet book whether they're hot and icy, opposites or giants or small, wiggly, wavy. One thing's for sure, every letter is unique and just beautifully illustrated, a charming little book.
Love it.
And this is such a great, hardly The Wizard of Oz can't be construed as a new book, but there are new editions always coming out. What I love about this, and this would be
and
for...
And we know you love The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, well, all 40 of the books. You know, there's a lot. Well, this has got the wizard, of course, because you got to have the wizard. That's what we all know. But it has two of Baum's other best. He wrote the first 14 of the 40 books, Emerald City of Oz and Glinda of Oz.
And what's this? This is just a new...
It's not that new.
Yeah.
But it's a newer Penguin Classic edition.
Talk about how it looks.
It's incredible.
It's just vibrant. The edges of the books are decorated with scenes from the novel. It's really... It's a fun, great gift-giving edition. And of course, knowing me, this is not a book at all, and it's not even new. This is a box of Leonardo da Vinci's flying machines by Andrew Dewar. And this man, hundreds of years ago, well, I don't know if we could say he invented flying, but he sure as hell understood it before anyone else did. Yeah. And so this is great because you can just pop open the box and make Leonardo's airplanes, flying airplanes. So who wouldn't love that?
That's great. All right, Betsy Burton, over to you.
I'm going to buy one of those.
I am too.
Okay, my first one is a holiday book. It's called The Gingerbread House Jack's Family Ate. And it's very much designed on the house that Jack built with the same kind of rhymes and whatnot. This is a beautiful gingerbread house. And what happens during the course of the book is that the family members, as they go about their Christmas business, they eat it piece by piece. By the time Santa gets there, there isn't one. There is not even a crumb. Then my very favorite, and I stole this from Kat because she brought it too, is Rocket Puppies by William Whoosh Joyce. And this is about Snarly McBummerpants, who lives on the island of Woe and wants everybody to be very, very unhappy and pretty much insists on it. And so they call out the pups, the rocket pups, and they're so cute. I wish you all out there could see these puppies. They are adorable. And the smallest one goes up to Snarly McBummerpants, kisses him on the nose, and a smile breaks out. And he becomes Happy, somebody McHappy Pants. I did know that. Smiley McHappy Pants. And the world becomes a beautiful place. So those are my two favorite picture books. My favorite chapter book by far is The Bletchley Riddle by Ruta Sepetys, how you say that, and Steve Shanken. It is about Bletchley. My husband and I both read it from cover to cover because it was so fun to read. It's a brother and a sister. He is there to break codes. She's only 14, and she breaks away from her duties to go to America and follows him to Bletchley, and they allow her to stay. So a brother and a sister, their mother has disappeared into Poland just before the war break out. The sister believes she's alive. The brother believes she's dead. And MI6 guy outside of Bletchley thinks she was a German spy. Mm. So that's the mystery. There's lots of coding and excitement. It's just a great read.
The Bletchley Riddle.
The Bletchley Riddle. Ruta Sepetys and Steve Shanken. Then, another great read, this in paper, The Winterton Deception, Final Word. Just briefly, I have to tell you, it's again about a brother and a sister, and they're looking for their father, who they've never known. But it is about a spelling bee that lasts just about the length of this entire book and kind of keeps you on edge, wondering how you spell this. And then a kind of treasure hunt about a Jane Austen manuscript. So there's all kinds of action in this book, and it is, again, just a great read. The Winterton Deception by, wait a minute, Janet Sumner Johnson.
All right. Wow. Kat.
Okay. My first choice is Mr. Lapron's Mystery Soup by Giovanna Zamboli. And this is one of those lovely books. It's almost old-fashioned in its palette and its lushness of illustrations. They are so watercolor and gouache, and they're so warm and vibrant. You could just fall into them. Mm. This is the story of a rabbit, Mr. Lapron, who loves vegetables, and he loves making soup, and everybody loves his soup. So he starts to scale it up. And he kind of gets this thing where he's serving soup, and people are wanting the soup all the time, and then he starts a business. And then he has a factory, and eventually he looks like he looks on the cover. And there is no joy in this rabbit's face. He is wearing a suit and tie, and he's a disapproving rabbit because he followed his dream, but he monetized it. This is a warning. This is a fable for the times, people.
Cautionary tale,
right?
Love what you love. And in the telling of this, it's not at all preachy in that way. It is just beautiful how he loves his soup and everybody loves him for his soup. Next one is Pigtown Party by Leon Cho. This is about a little girl who gets something in her mail slot. It's an invitation to a party, and it's addressed to Cutie. Now, her name isn't Cutie, but she is a cutie. She knows she's a cutie. She's not familiar with any of this, but by God, she's going to that party, and she goes to a party that's full of pigs, and it's a costume party, and they're all complimenting her on her costume because she looks like a human. They give her the best costume award, where she gets in a fight with the pig named Cutie over the whole thing, because it's rude. That was Cutie's invitation and Cutie's party, and now they're fighting over this big cake. She takes the cake, she makes a break for it, and man, she's going. And you'll just have to read it to see what happens.
I can't wait.
Whether it's really a morality tale or not, that's up to you. Finally, the last one is Bakery Dragon by Devin L. Kurtz. And this is one of those warm, lovely books as well, but fun because dragons. Nobody loves anything more than a mysterious bakery and dragons both. It's a great picture book that weaves them so well together. Final shout out to a middle grade reader, Impossible Creatures by Catherine Rundell. Mm. So worth the buzz it's getting right now.
She was delightful, by the way. We had her on the show.
She's terrific.
Incredible. All right. Can you guys make this quick?
Yes.
Let's do a lightning round. And Betsy, I'm going to have you begin.
Okay. These are all mysteries. The Drowned by John Banville. Quirk, the Pathologist. Presumed Guilty by Scott Turow. The attorney is Rusty from Presumed Innocent, and it reads just as well.
Does it?
Oh, it's great. Death at the Sign of the Rook. That's a Jackson Brody book, and it's a mystery weekend mystery. And The Waiting by Michael Connelly. Michael Connelly of Bosch fame with his female sidekick, Brody, I think her name is, and Maddie, his daughter.
Yeah, wow, got some mysteries in. Great, right. Kat.
By the Fire We Carry, The Generations-Long Fight for Justice on Native Land by Rebecca Nagel. This is important. This is about a really important Supreme Court case and the history of indigenous people and the stories we tell ourselves as a nation about who we are and what we are. Next is Pass the Plate by Carolina Gellin. This is a young woman who was born in Transylvania. She lives in Salt Lake now. Massive influencer on Instagram, but she makes a great recipe, accessible and tasty. Let's Go to the Mall and 80s Seek and Find by Sally Nixon. This is a seek and find for grown-ups.
Oh, lovely. Wow. Ken.
I'm going to go all local, Doug. Jasmine Gallegos is a local book artist and journal maker, makes these one-of-a-kind, beautiful blank journals, some with, you know, lined paper, some without, in all manner of shapes and forms. My actual favorite one, of course, because I'm a vinyl junkie, this is a vinyl record logbook.
Oh, man, that's going to sell.
My condition collection would not fit in there. And lastly, old friend Rod Carney, poet from Happy Valley down south. He's got a new book of poems out called The Book of Drought, poems by Rob Carney.
Ken Sanders Rare Books on at the Leonardo Museum in downtown Salt Lake City. We have Catherine Weller with us here of Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. Betsy Burton, for many years, was the co-owner of the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. Good job, you guys. We got to more than I thought we would. That was really incredible. We have a complete list of all of these books that we discussed today, even the ones that we didn't get to, because we didn't get to all of them, on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And the program, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover, Carrie Watson, our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.